las operaciones de deportación en el área de Los Ángeles. Pero si lo detienen agentes de ICE, usted tiene derechos constitucionales sin importar su estatus migratorio. Si usted o alguien que conoce ha sido detenido o desea denunciar a ICE, puede obtener más información en CHIRLA, llamando al 888-624-4752 para obtener ayuda legal y recursos. Es un servicio bilingüe. Para más información, visite chirla.org.
This is Gary Oldman. You're listening to radio powered by the people. KPFK 90.7 FM.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Eco Justice Radio acknowledges that we recorded this show on the traditional territory of the Ohlone people and all of their relatives in the place we call Berkeley, California. Welcome, I'm Jack Eight. On today's show, The Power of Place, Bioregional Solutions to the Climate Crisis, we feature a panel discussion from the 2025 Bioneers Conference featuring Ariel Deranger, co-founder and executive director, Indigenous Climate Action, Thomas Lindsay, senior legal counsel, Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights, and Colette Pichon-Battle, vision and initiatives partner from Taproot Earth, moderated by Justin Winters, co-founder and executive director of One Earth. As climate breakdown escalates, communities must realize that climate action and resilience hinge on both ecological boundaries and mapped political boundaries. Local watersheds, food production zones, and clean and not clean energy distribution networks, as well as cultural gathering centers, they define our communities. Ecological maps should overlay and overcome our line-drawn, often gerrymandered political maps to engender meaningful strategic collective action. The term bioregional might seem, wonky, but think of it as how we define ourselves as part of the land, water, wind, and seas. And how do we come together as communities on a regional basis to fight for the land and water in the face of the repeal of environmental protections, business as usual founts of air and water pollution, and political dominance of sacrifice zones and communities for energy, real estate, and commerce? What might political ecological alliances look like to advance climate action that address urgent bioregional realities? On this show, we feature a visionary group of leading-edge climate action organizers at the 2025 Bioneers Conference. Look it up. Check it out. You will never be in a conference hall with this many important Earth advocates. They tell us about emerging forms of eco-governance that center equity and justice. We feature global indigenous climate leader Ariel Deranger, leading rights of nature attorney Thomas Lindsay, and climate justice organizer and lawyer Colette Pichon-Battle, whose Taproot Earth nonprofit works in the Gulf South and Appalachia. The session is moderated by One Earth founder Justin Winters, whose science-based climate solutions framework focuses on renewable energy, regenerative agriculture, and land and biodiversity conservation. For more keynote talks, conversations, performances, go to bioneers.org.
My name is Justin Winters. I'm the co-founder and executive director of One Earth. It's a nonprofit that is dedicated to advancing science-backed, community-driven solutions to the twin crises of climate change and biodiversity loss. This panel, just so that we can kind of set up the conversation, is called Going Global Local, Bioregional Climate Action. It's about rethinking how and where we take action, aligning our climate strategies with the ecological systems that truly sustain us, our watersheds, our food sheds, our cultures, and doing so in ways that center justice, equity, and local leadership. Really thrilled to be here with this crew, and I'm just going to kind of read some of their bios. Colette is a is a fierce advocate for climate justice rooted in her home of Bayou Liberty, Louisiana. A lawyer and community leader, Colette spent nearly two decades building the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy to serve communities of color in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Today, she co-leads Taproot Earth, whose new initiative, Gulf South to Appalachia, is advancing the traditions of Southern freedom struggle by building a regional movement rooted in self-determination and collective power. Great to have you. Ariel Deranger, a longtime friend and ally. She is a powerful voice for Indigenous rights and climate justice. She's a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. Ariel is the co-founder and executive director of Indigenous Climate Action and a representative of the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change. She also serves on the board here at Bioneers and was recently named a recipient of the 2024 Climate Breakthrough Award. Amazing. From organizing divestment campaigns to leading mass mobilizations against the fossil fuel industry, Ariel's activism spans grassroots to global arenas. So you're perfect for this conversation. And lastly, we have Thomas Lindsay. He is a pioneer in environmental law and a true visionary in the community rights movement. Thomas Lindsay is a senior legal counsel for the Center of Democratic and Environmental Rights and is widely recognized for drafting the world's first rights of nature law. He also consulted on Ecuador's groundbreaking constitutional provisions protecting the rights of nature. Thomas has authored several books, including We the People, Stories from Community Rights Movement in the United States. Welcome, Thomas. I really wanted to have each of the panelists share their experiences on the ground driving bioregional community-driven action, because they all have incredible stories. And much of their work is starting to grow much more global. But it all started with place-based, community-driven work that is really fascinating and empowering. So why don't I kick it over to you, Ariel, to share your story.
She's picking on me because we met in my community over a decade ago. Again, my name is Ariel Tsaekwi Deranger, and I'm a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. And I believe either 2013 or 2014, we can't decide which year, Justin joined a team of people, a delegation that was coming to my community to learn about what was happening. So I come from the Treaty 8 territories of Northern Alberta, and my community is an Arctic Zone A community. So we live just where the permafrost begins. And our community is also downstream to one of the largest industrial projects on planet Earth, the Alberta Tar Sands. And so Justin came with a delegation of some pretty high-profile individuals. And oddly enough, the only person I still talk to is Justin. But it was a really great experience just being able to invite people into our community, because this is a part of how we take the local stories and bring them to a global stage. Our community is a First Nations community, signatories to Treaty 8, and within the Treaty 8 negotiations and the agreements, we were told that we would have a say over what happens in our lands and territories, and that we would share the land. However, that hasn't actually happened. We've seen and how Indigenous peoples are treated across the Americas, and particularly in North America. And those treaties have been breached over and over and over and over again. But most recently, in the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, we saw a rampant expansion of what is now known as the Alberta Tar Sands. These projects had some of the most irreversible and extreme impacts on the lands, on the waterways, on the economies, on the lives and health of communities downstream. And my community is one of those. And Justin and I were talking about how her experience coming to my community was so profound that it changed her. Because it doesn't matter how many images you see or videos you see of the Alberta tar sands, being there and experiencing it firsthand and the extent of how big it is you can't imagine it. You have to experience it. And for me, this is deeply, deeply personal. These are not just simply some ecosystem that I want to protect. These are the homelands of my people, the place that we existed in since time immemorial. Our traditional name is the Kaitale Dene Sotlane, which means the people of the land, the people of the Willow. And the Willow is a reference to the Athabasca Delta, which is one of the world's last remaining inland freshwater deltas. It is so revered for its biodiversity that it is also home to a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Wood Buffalo National Park. Yet, the rights of my community continue to be violated through the expansion of this project. And between the years of 2007 and 2017, I had to think about that, I was the spokesperson for my community challenging the expansion of the Alberta tar sands. So I worked directly with the elders in my community, those that were dealing with cancers, autoimmune diseases, respiratory diseases, hunters, fishers, and trappers that were harvesting animals that were diseased, that were not able to feel secure in drinking water collected from the river systems anymore because it was so contaminated and people were developing rare forms of bile duct cancer. I was helping to amplify these things of my community, and through the whole time, I was also experiencing the deep grief and trauma that we all collectively felt. My uncle, the late Pat Duranger, said to me, "Your name, Ariel-Tse-Ekwi, which is a Dene name, which means Thunder Woman, is your responsibility. You are the thunder, the sound that is carried from the action of the lightning. And you must carry the actions of our people farther than people can see. It is your job to be the spokesperson for our community." That was a huge responsibility to put on me when I was in my 20s. I was just like, how? But I had a lot of really great life experiences that ended up taking me into the UN International Forums. I started attending the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, where I actually helped to create the UN Indigenous Caucus. So the Global Indigenous Youth Caucus in 2007 to 2008, we were formalized as a recognized caucus. And in those spaces, one of the things I realized is that the issues of my community, as bad as they were, as horrific as they were not unique. That the experiences of Indigenous people globally was the same over and over and over again. If it wasn't tar sands, it was gold mining. If it wasn't gold mining, it was deforestation. If it wasn't deforestation, it was mega hydro. If it wasn't mega hydro, it was palm oil plantations, and on and on and on we go. The story was that for many Indigenous peoples, climate change didn't start with the Industrial Revolution. It started with first contact. Colonialism was the main driver of climate change for our communities because the climate changed for us. The lands changed for us. The ways in which we were able to operate and be in relationships with our lands changed for us when colonizers came and said that our ways of being were heathenistic, demonic. They had no value in the society of progress and development. And I realized that my experiences in my home community and having the support of my community to challenge this could give strength to other peoples that didn't know what to do. So where do I go now? After years of working with my community to challenge and bringing really incredible names and people into my community, where we were able to stop and circumvent projects that were of massive scales. I believe the Tech Resource Frontier Mine was Tech Frontier Mine, by the way, like, really? That mine, I believe, was the size of like Edmonton, and I don't know what that means, a city of 1 million people. That project was stopped because our community kept intervening and intervening and intervening over and over again, and we cost the company $20 million over the course of like 2 years by interrupting their project. In the end, I believe they said that we cost them next to $10 billion over the course of 12 years of interventions. We were also able to stop the Shell Jackpine Mine expansion project and the Pierre River Mine project. We were able to stop project after project, but at the end of the day, we needed to do more than stop individual projects. It was about changing the lived realities for our communities. And I realized that wasn't going to, I couldn't just do this for my own community. It needed to be something that involves systemic change. So then I realized I needed to start working with more communities. And I had more Indigenous communities from all across North America being like, how did you do this? How did you get your people to stop? Didn't they get enticed by all the jobs and all the fancy things that the oil and gas companies offered? And I said, yes, they did, but we stood our ground. How did you do it? And soon I was talking to people about trading strategies and how we could build collective movements. And I knew at that moment that I could no longer continue to work for my nation. And my chief said to me, "You've outgrown this. Your job now is to take what you've learned and share it with the rest of our communities." And I took that experience to build what is now known as Indigenous Climate Action, which is Canada's only Indigenous-led climate justice organization, where we work to build tools and resources to empower Indigenous communities to take the lead in setting the stage and the foundations for what real climate solutions are. And one of the most incredible reports that we created that I think is so important in the context of discussing real solutions to the climate crisis is that Indigenous people say things like, "We are nature defending itself. We are the front lines of the climate crisis." But people use that as this romanticized, tokenistic thing. But we authored a report with Oil Change International and Indigenous Environmental Network that was called Indigenous Resistance Against Carbon. And it took the highest profiled Indigenous land defense movements from Turtle Island over the course of 10 years, and it quantified what those projects mitigated, from how much carbon was mitigated from Indigenous land defense. Some of those projects were still in the process of being fought, but if all those projects were stopped and circumvented and preventing from happening, it would create the equivalent mitigated emissions of 26% of the annual emissions of Canada and the United States combined. So when we criminalize land defenders, we are literally stopping the mitigation of actual emissions from being produced. This is real climate action. But that only can happen if we continue to respect and value and nurture Indigenous cultures and ways of being. That we remember what our connections are to the land. That we remember what it means to be Dene Sotlane, which is to flow from the land, to be from the land. That when we reduce the climate crisis to a mathematical equation to be solved by balancing the carbon in the atmosphere, we are actually missing a key purpose, because it'll be so easy to just move numbers here and there and not think about the social impacts. For us, we have to remember that colonization, capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, and extractivism are at the roots of this. And that we need to not just restore the balance of the parts per million in the atmosphere, but we need to restore the balance with ourselves, with each other, and with the planet. And the global Indigenous movement is growing, but we cannot be reduced to some romanticized stewards of the land as if we are some antiquated versions of who we are. We are modern people with modern solutions, and we are taking real action. And some of that is rooted in language preservation, food security and food sovereignty movements. It is revitalization of cultures and practices that connect us to the lands and who we are as Indigenous peoples. And we are seeing this prove time and time again that Indigenous land tenure, land back, is a key driver in mitigating carbon, but also protecting biodiversity and driving solutions that develop economic and social systems that are just and fair. So as I embark on Climate Breakthrough, I'm taking the lessons that I've learned from my community, from the work that I've done with Indigenous Climate Action, to replicate this at a global scale with global communities. I've just started, so don't ask me exactly what I'm going to do, but I'm really excited to be working with a global community to figure out how we can take these same resources, the same love, the same drive for our culture, and impact policy, just transition, loss and damages, all of the negotiated pieces within the international fora to drive real policy that is just and fair for Indigenous peoples, for the planet, and for all of our brothers and sisters that are suffering from the impacts of colonization, capitalism, and white supremacy. Thank you.
Thanks, Ariel.
Thanks, Justin.
Hello, listeners. Quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. We air on KPFK Los Angeles. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests, listen to extended episodes, and get connected with us on social media. Today, you're listening to The Power of Place, Bioregional Solutions to the Climate Crisis. I'm your host, Jack Eyte, and we feature a panel discussion from the 2025 Bioneers Conference, featuring Ariel Duranger of Indigenous Climate Action, Thomas Lindsay of the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights, and Colette Pichon Battle of Taproot Earth, moderated by Justin Winters of One Earth.
And now, Thomas, you get to go after Ariel.
So our current environmental activism in the United States sucks. And it sucks because we're so obedient to a system of law and government that's been delivered to us, and we're on the receiving end of it. So when we get a proposal for a frack well, or for a toxic waste incinerator, or for a 20,000 head hog factory farm, or something coming into our particular community, we're basically told there's nothing we can do except to appeal the permit that's been issued for that particular project. And so that has us scrambling to like the state environmental agency, and we hire a lawyer, and then we do these permit comments, and we put the permit comments in. If we aren't listened to, then we bring a lawsuit, which is what I did for about 12 years. It was bring lawsuits on behalf of community organizations who had been the good kids and filed the permit comments and done all that kind of stuff. And then we would go into court, and we would argue to the judge that the corporation that put the permit application had forgotten something or missed something in their permit application. And because that's what environmental lawyers do in the United States today, is they look at these 1,000-page corporate permit applications, and then they argue to judges about why they shouldn't have been issued. We're all so obedient to this whole thing because, and it's obedience because the industry that is proposing the project coming into your community were the ones who wrote the regulations in the first place underneath which the project is coming in. And then when we come in as communities to try to stop it, we're actually arguing under the corporation's own regulations that were put in the first place. How dumb is that, right? And how predictable it is that we are where we are now, which is we are losing. In fact, we have lost big chunks of almost everything at this point. This global local concept, to me, is about taking the activism that traditionally has been expended for no really good reason at the state level or the federal level or the international level. I watch with pain at the international climate negotiations that are taking place because they are zero going on zero going on zero. It's like, The fact is, it's more just a negotiation about who's going to pay who for the damage, but nobody's really talking about stopping climate change at this point. It's all about mitigation, and we all lie to each other. Sometimes we get into groups and, you know, we say, you know, this is the beginning of the beginning of something big. Well, we're kind of at the end of the end of something big, which is we can't even imagine what 1.5 degrees Celsius change looks like. It's the planet becomes uninhabitable, yet we are doing almost nothing at this point to stop that from happening. So on climate specifically, the fact is that there's all kinds of things that we could do if we were less obedient to the system. So in 2016, a little case called Juliana versus the United States. It was a climate change case brought by youth, recently got thrown out by the U.S. Supreme Court, in fact, last week or the week before. But in the course of this litigation, which took 12 or 13 years, because that's how long it takes to go through the courts, that a judge in Oregon, a district court judge, actually put out an opinion. It's been lost to the weeds at this point, pretty much. But she said that we all have a civil right to a sustainable, livable climate, a constitutional right to a livable climate. So we said to ourselves, well, why isn't that being written down anywhere, like in your community? Like if you wanted to pass a law, a local law, that said everybody in the community has a constitutional right to a sustainable climate, and pass that law. You know, like in New Hampshire, you need 10 signatures on a petition to put something in front of a town meeting to make a binding law in the community. What would that look like? What if we put 350 ppm into law? What if we made it a legal standard and then we're able to sue companies and sue others, utilities, who are automatically violating that threshold? And you might say to me, well, Thomas, that's nuts, because that's not where climate change stuff activism gets done. That's at a higher level. What good is it do we do it at a local level? And I would say to you, it's not being done anywhere at all right now. So that's like a plus one if it's done locally. So that work on climate stuff, which needs to be done, a small community in Colorado, Lafayette, Colorado, actually did that. The community put a local law together that was passed municipally that recognized the right, constitutional right, to a sustainable, livable climate within the city of Lafayette. And then they used it to chase a fracking company out of town, saying that if you frack here, you're violating our right to a sustainable climate. It's about putting in the standard and then actually using the standard to leverage these lawsuits. And I know all this is probably above most of us. When we talk about lawsuits or lawyers, you know, our eyes roll back and we think, well, we're not the people to do that. I'm here to say you are. You know, we have lost all agency. And I'm talking mostly municipal communities here, because indigenous communities, I found, have plenty of agency. But municipal communities, you know, white progressive communities in the United States, people feel they have no agency. Who am I to do something like that? I can't do something like that. I'll go to conferences and I'll applaud at other people that are doing stuff, but I can't do it here, right? I can't do it here. Well, you can. In fact, in many ways, part of our history is about people seeing themselves as lawmakers, law drafters, law adopters. And it's scary. But I've seen 500 communities in the United States actually make that transformation. You know, when I gave up litigating in courts against stupid permit appeal provisions and going in front of judges and losing to Monsanto and Waste Management Company and having their lawyers thank me after the hearings, after I had found something wrong with the permit application that they had submitted, because it allowed their law firm to bill more hours to the company to actually fill in the gaps, omissions, and deficiencies that we had identified within those permit appeals, that we basically quit doing environmental law and we began working with communities to draft their own laws and then enforce those laws in those communities. So what does that look like? Well, communities began passing laws recognizing their right to clean air and clean water. Believe it or not, we have no guarantee in the United States of clean air or clean water. People think, well, the Clean Water Act does that or the Clean Air Act does that. Nope. Doesn't set standards, parts per million and other things, but it doesn't say you have a right to clean air or clean water. We live in a myth. This country is a myth. The concept, the argument that we have a democracy is a myth. It's a myth because when we try to use it, we're told that we can't. We live in a country in which corporate rights outweigh the rights of our communities. And until we pick that fight in a meaningful way, in something that strikes across the country as a counterweight to what's happening right now with the federal government being dismantled, state governments not doing because basically they don't. It's decentralizing that power structure that has to happen in the U.S. today. And that means us seeing ourselves as law drafters, you know, lawmakers, law adopters, even though it seems like it's beyond us.
It's really been an honor to be in conversation with you all. Thank you for sharing those stories.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, The Power of Place, Bioregional Solutions to the Climate Crisis. Thank you to the Bioneers Conference and panelists, Ariel Deranger, Colette Pichon-Battle, Thomas Lindsay, and Justin Winters. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer, myself, Jack Eit, co-host, Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
What's going on, family? From the Bay to L.A., My name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law and Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters, the weekly state terror roundup, resistance in residence with artists using their gifts to change the world, and letters from the inside. That's just a small taste of what this show is about as we seek to expose, agitate, and build. Tune in Monday through Thursday at 8 a.m. on 90.5.